Chapter 5. "My dear sister and very good lady," said King Edmund, "you must now show your courage, for I tell you plainly we are in no small danger."
"What is it, Edmund?" asked the queen.
"It is this," said Edmund. "I do not think we shall find it easy to leave Tashpan. While the prince had hope that you would take him, we were honored guests. But by the lion's mane, I think that as soon as he has your flat denial, we shall be no better than their prisoners. One of the dwarves gave a low whistle.
I warned you,
said Swallowpad the raven. "Easily in, but not easily out," as the lobster said to the lobster pot.
"I have been with the prince this morning," continued Edmund. "He is little used, more than pity, to having his will crossed. And he is very chaffed at your long delays and doubtful answers. This morning he pressed very hard to know your mind. I put it aside, meaning at the same time to diminish his hopes, with some light common jests about women's fancies, and hinted that his suit was likely to be cold. He grew angry and dangerous. There was a sort of threatening, though still veiled, under a show of courtesy in every word he spoke."
"Yes," said Tumnus, "and when I supped with the Grand Vizier last night, it was the same. He asked me how I liked Tashpan, and I, for I could not tell him I hated every stone of it, and I would not lie, told him that now with high summer was coming on, my heart turned to the cool woods and dewy slopes of Narnia. He gave me a smile that meant no good, and said, 'There is nothing to hinder you from dancing there again, little Goatfoot, always provided you leave us in exchange a bride for our prince.'"
"Do you mean he would make me his wife by force?" exclaimed Susan.
"That is my fear," said Edmund. "Wife or slave, which is worse?"
"But how can he? Does a Tisrock think our brother the High King would suffer such an outrage?
"Sire," said Peredin to the king, "they would not be so mad. Do they think there are no swords and spears in Narnia?"
"Alas," said Edmund, "my guess is that the Tisrock has very small fear of Narnia. We are a very little land, and little lands on the borders of a great empire are always hateful to the lords of the great empire. He longs to blot them out, gobble them up. When first he suffered the prince to come to Cair Pyrvel as your lover, sister, it may be that he was only seeking an occasion against us. Most likely he hopes to make one mouthful of Narnia and Arshenland both."
"Let him try," said the second dwarf. "At sea, we are as big as he is, and if he assaults us by land, he has the desert to cross."
"True, friend," said Edmund, "but is the desert a sure defense? What does Shallowpad say?"
"I know that desert well," said the raven, "for I have flown above it far and wide in my younger days." You may be sure that Shasta pricked up his ears at this point. "And this is certain, that if the Tisrock goes by the great oasis, he can never lead a great army across it into Archenland. For though they could reach the oasis by the end of their first day's march, yet the springs there would be too little for the thirst of all those soldiers and all their beasts. But there is another way." Shasta listened more attentively still.
"He that would find that way," said the raven, "must start from the tombs of the ancient kings and ride northwest so that the double peak of Mount Pyre is always straight ahead of him. And so, in a day's riding, or a little more, he shall come to the head of a stony valley, which is so narrow that a man might be within a furlong of it 1,000 times, and never know that it was there. Looking down into this valley, he will see neither grass nor water nor anything else good. But if he rides on down it, he will come to a river, and can ride by the water all the way into Archenland."
"And do the Calamarins know of this western way?" the queen asked.
Friends, said Edmund, "what is the use of all of this discourse?
We are not asking whether Narnia or Calmarin would win if a war arose between them. We are asking how to save the honor of the queen and our own lives out of this devilish city. For though my brother Peter, the High King, defeated the Tisrock a dozen times over, yet long before that day our throats would be cut and the queen's grace would be that of the wife, or more likely a slave, of this prince. We do have our weapons, king, said the first dwarf, and this is a reasonably defensible house. As to that, said the king, I do not doubt that every one of us would sell our lives dearly in the gate, and they would not come at the queen but over our dead bodies. Yet we should be merely rats fighting in a trap when all is said and done. Very true, croaked the raven. The last stands in a house makes good stories, but nothing ever comes of them. After their first repulses, the enemy always sets the house on fire. I am the cause of all of this, said Susan, bursting into tears. Oh, if I had never left Caer Paravel. Our last happy day was before those ambassadors came from Calmarin. The moles were planting an orchard for us, and oh, and she buried her face into her hands and sobbed. Courage, Sue, courage, said Edmund. Remember, but what is the matter with you, Master Tumnus? For the fawn was holding both his horns with his hands as if he were trying to keep his head on by them and writhing to and fro as if he had a pain in his inside. Don't speak to me, don't speak to me, said Tumnus. I'm thinking so that I can hardly breathe. Wait, do wait. There was a moment's puzzled silence, and then the fawn looked up, drew a long breath, mopped its forehead, and said, "The only difficulty is how to get down to our ship, with some stores, too, without being seen and stopped." "Yes," said the dwarf dryly, "just as the beggar's only difficulty about riding is that he has no horse." "Wait, wait," said Mr. Tumnus impatiently. All we need is some pretext for going down to our ship today and taking stuff on board. Yes, said King Edmund doubtfully. Well then, said the fawn, how would it be if your majesties bade the prince to a great banquet to be held on board our galleon, the Splendor Helene, tomorrow night? And let the message be worded as graciously as the queen can contrive without pledging her honor, so as to give the prince a hope that she is weakening. This is very good counsel, sire, croaked the raven. And then, continued Tumnus excitedly, everyone will expect us to be going down to the ship all day, making preparations for our guests. And let some of us go to the bazaars and spend, you know, every minimum that we have at the fruiteers, at the sweetmeat sellers, the wine merchants, just as we would if we were really giving a feast. Let us order magicians, jugglers, dancing girls, flute players, all to be on board tomorrow night. I see, said Edmund, rubbing his hands together. And then, said Tumnus, still excited, we'll all be on board tonight, and as soon as it's quite dark, up sails and out soars, said the king. And so to sea, cried Tumnus, leaping up and beginning to dance. And our nose northward, said the first dwarf. Running for home, hurrah for Narnia in the north, said the other. And the prince, waking next morning and finding his birds flown, said Peredin, clapping his hands. Oh, Master Tumnus, dear Master Tumnus, said the queen, clutching his hands and swinging with him as he danced. You have saved us all. The prince will chase us, said another lord, whose name Shasta had not yet heard. That's the least of my fears, said Edmund. I have seen all the shipping in the river, and there's no tall ship of war, nor swift galley here. I wish she may chase us, for the slender Helene could sink anything he has to send after her, if we were overtaken at all, that is. Sire, said the raven, we shall hear no better plot than the fawns, though we had sat at council for 7 days. Now, as we birds say, nests before eggs, which is as much as to say, let us all take our food and then at once be about our business.
Everyone arose at this, and the doors were opened, and the lords and the creatures stood aside for the king and queen to go first. Shasta wondered what he ought to do, but Mr. Tumnus said, "Lie there, your highness, and I'll bring you up a little feast to yourself in a few moments. There's no need for you to move until we are all ready to embark." Shasta laid his head down again on the pillows, and soon he was alone in the room. "Now this is perfectly dreadful," he thought to himself. It never came into his head to tell these Narnians the whole truth and ask for their help. Having been brought up by a hard, close-fisted man like Arshish, he had a fixed habit of never telling grown-ups anything if he could help it. He thought they would always spoil or stop whatever you were trying to do. And, of course, he thought that it would be even worse if the Narnian king might be friendly to the two horses because they were talking beasts of Narnia. He would hate Arvaris because she was a Calamarine and either sell her for a slave or send her back to her father. As for himself, "I simply daren't tell them that I'm not Prince Corrin now," he thought. "I've heard all their plans. If they knew I wasn't one of them, they'd never let me out of this house alive. They'd be afraid I'd betray them to the Tizrock. They'd probably kill me. And if the real Corrin turns up, it'll all come out, and they will." He had, you see, no idea of how noble and free-born people actually behave. "What am I to do? What am I to do?" he kept saying to himself. "What? Hello, here comes that goaty little creature again." The fawn trotted in, half-dancing, with a tray in its hands, which was nearly as large as itself. This he sat on the island table between Shasta's sofa, and he sat down himself on the carpeted floor with his goaty legs crossed. "Now, Princeling," he said, "make a good dinner. It'll be your last meal in Tashban." It was a fine meal after the Calamarine fashion. I don't know whether you have liked it or not, but Shasta did. There were lobsters and salads, snipes stuffed with almonds and truffles, a complicated dish made of chicken livers and rice, raisins, and nuts. There were also cool melons and gooseberry fools and mulberry fools, every kind of nice thing that could have been made with ice. There was also a little flagon of the sort of wine that's called white, though it's really yellow. While Shasta was eating, the good little fawn, who thought he was still dazed with sunstroke, kept talking to him about the fine things he would have when they all got home, about his good old father, King Loon of Archenland, and the little castle where he lived on the southern slopes of the pass. "And don't forget," said Mr. Tumnus, "that you are promised your first suit of armor and your first war horse on your next birthday. And then your highness will begin to learn how to tilt and joust. In a few years, if all goes well, King Peter has promised your royal father that he himself will make you knight at Caer Paravel. In the meantime, there will be plenty of comings and goings between Narnia and Archenland across the neck of the mountains. Of course, you remember you have promised to come for a whole week to stay with me for the summer festival, and there will be bonfires and all-night dances of fauns and dryads in the heart of the woods, and who knows, we might even see Aslan himself." When the meal was over, the fawn told Shasta to stay quietly where he was. "It won't do you any harm to have a little sleep," he added. "I'll call you in plenty of time to get on board. And then, home, Narnia and the North." Shasta had so enjoyed his dinner and all the things Tumnus had been telling him that when he was left alone, his thoughts took a different turn. He only hoped now that the real Prince Corrin would not turn up until it was too late, and that he would be taken away to Narnia by ship. I'm afraid he did not think at all of what might happen to the real Corrin when he was left behind in Tashban. He was a little worried about Arvaris and Bree waiting for him at the tombs, but then he said to himself, "Well, how can I help it? And anyways, that Arvaris thinks she's too good to go about with me, so she can jolly well go alone." And at the same time, he couldn't help feeling that it would be much nicer going to Narnia by sea and toiling across the desert. When he had thought all of these things, as he did,
what I expect you would have done if you had been up very early and had a long walk and a great deal of excitement and then a very good meal. We're lying on a soft sofa in a cool room with no noise in it except when a bee came buzzing in through the wide windows. He, of course, fell asleep. What woke him up was a loud crash. He jumped off the sofa, staring. He saw at once, from the mere look of the room, the lights and shadows all looked different. That he must have slept for several hours. He also saw what had made the crash. A costly porcelain vase, which had been standing on the windowsill, now lay on the floor, but broken in about 30 pieces. But these things he hardly noticed. What he did notice was two hands gripping the windowsill from outside. They gripped harder and harder, getting white at the knuckles. And then up came a head and a pair of shoulders. A moment later, there was a boy of Shasta's own age sitting astride the sill with one leg hanging down inside the room. Shasta had never seen his own face in a looking glass. Even if he had, he might not have even realized that the other boy was, at ordinary times, almost exactly like himself. At the moment, this boy was not particularly like anyone, for he had the finest black eye you had ever seen. A tooth was missing, and his clothes, which must have been splendid ones when he had put them on, were torn and dirty. There was both blood and mud all over his face as well. "Who are you?" said the boy in a whisper. "Are you Prince Corrin?" Shasta asked. "Why, of course," said the other. "But, again, who are you?" "Oh, I'm nobody. Nobody in particular, I mean," said Shasta. "King Edmund caught me in the street and mistook me for you. I suppose we must look like each other. Can I get out the way you got in?" "Why, yes, if you're any good at climbing," said Corrin. "But why are you in such a hurry? I say we ought to be able to get some fun out of this, being mistaken for one another." "No, no," said Shasta. "We must change places at once. It'll be simply frightful if Mr. Tumnus comes back and finds us both here. I've had to pretend to be you, and you're starting tonight, secretly. And where were you all of this time?" "A boy in the street made a beastly joke about Queen Susan," said Prince Corrin. "So I knocked him down. He ran howling into a house, and his big brother came out. So I knocked the big brother down. Then they all followed me until we ran into three old men with spears who were called the Watch. So I fought the Watch, and they knocked me down. It was getting dark by that point. Then the Watch took me along to lock me up somewhere. So I asked them if they'd like a stoup of wine, and they said they didn't mind if they did. Then I took them to a wine shop and got them some, and they all sat down and drank till they fell asleep. I thought it was time for me to be off, so I came out quietly, and then I found the first boy, the one who had started all this trouble. He was still hanging around, so I knocked him down again. After that, I climbed up a pipe onto the roof of a house and lay quietly till it began to get light this morning. Ever since, I've been finding my way back. I say, is there anything to drink around here?" "No, I drink it all," says Shasta. "And now, show me how you got in. There's not a minute to lose. You better lie down on that sofa and pretend... but I forgot. It'll be no good with all those bruises and that black eye. You'll just have to tell them the truth once I'm safely away, I guess." "What else did you think I'd be telling them?" asked the prince in a rather angry look. "And who are you? You never told me." "Oh, there's no time," says Shasta in a frantic whisper. "I'm a Narnian, I believe. Something Narnian, anyway. But I've been brought up all my life in Calamarin, and I'm escaping across the desert with a talking horse called Bree, and now, quick, how do I get away?" "Look," said Corrin, "drop from this window onto the roof of the veranda. But you must do it lightly on your toes, or someone's going to hear you. Then along to your left, and you can get up to the top of that wall if you're any good at all as a climber. Then along that wall over there to the corner, drop onto the rubbish heap, and you'll find on the outside, and there you are." "Thanks," said Shasta, who was already sitting on the sill. The two boys were looking into each other's faces, and suddenly found that they were great friends. "Goodbye," said Corrin, "and good luck. I do hope you get safe away." "Goodbye," Shasta said. "I say, you have been having some adventures." "Nothing to yours," said the prince. "Now drop lightly, I say," he added as Shasta dropped. "I hope we meet in Archenland. Go to my father, King Loon, and tell him you're a friend of mine. Oh, look out, I hear someone coming."
Chapter 6. Shasta ran lightly along the roof on tiptoes. It felt hot to his bare feet. He was only a few seconds scrambling up the wall at the far end, and when he got to the corner, he found himself looking down into a narrow, smelly street. There was the rubbish heap against the outside of the wall, just as Corrin had told him. Before jumping down, he took a rapid glance around him to get his bearings. Apparently, he had now come over the crown of the island hill on which Tashban is built. Everything sloped away before him, low flat roofs, down to the towers and battlements of the city's northern wall. Beyond that was the river, and beyond the river, a short slope covered with gardens. But beyond that again, there was something he had never seen the like of. A great yellowish-gray thing, flat as a calm sea, and stretching on for miles and miles. On the far side of it were huge blue things, lumpy but with jagged edges, and some of them had white tops. The desert, the mountains, Shasta thought to himself. He jumped down into the rubbish and began trotting along downhill as fast as he could in the narrow lane, which soon brought him into a wilder street where there were more people. No one bothered to look at a little ragged boy running along on bare feet. Still, he was anxious and uneasy till he turned a corner and there saw the city gate in front of him. Here he was pressed and jostled a bit, for a good many other people were also going out. On the bridge beyond the gate, the crowd became quite a slow procession, more like a queue than a crowd. Out there, with clear running water on each side, it was deliciously fresh after the smell and heat and noise of Tashban. When once Shasta had reached the far end of the bridge, he found the crowd melting away. Everyone seemed to be going either to the left or to the right along the riverbank. He went straight ahead up a road that did not appear to be much used between the gardens. In a few paces he was alone, and a few more brought him to the top of the slope. There he stood and stared. It was like coming to the end of the world, for all the grass stopped quite suddenly a few feet before him, and the sand began. Endless level sand like a seashore, but a bit rougher because it was never wet. The mountains, which now looked farther off than ever before, loomed ahead. Greatly was to his relief, he saw about 5 minutes walk away to his left what must certainly be the tombs, just as Bree has described them. Great masses of moldering stone shaped like gigantic beehives, but a little narrower. They looked very black and grim, for the sun was now setting right behind them. He turned his face west and trotted towards the tombs. He could not help looking out very hard for any sign of his friends, though the setting sun shone in his face so that he could hardly see anything. "And anyway," he said, "of course they'll be round on the far side of the farthest tomb, not this side where anyone might see them from the city." There were about 12 tombs, each with a low arched doorway that opened into absolute darkness. They were dotted about in a kind of order so that it took a long time going around this one and going around that one before you could be sure that you looked around every one, every side of every tomb. This is, of course, what Shasta had to do. And, of course, there was nobody there. It was very quiet here out the edge of the desert, and now the sun really had set. Suddenly, from somewhere behind him, there came a terrible sound. Shasta's heart gave a great jump, and he had to bite his tongue to keep himself from screaming. Next moment, he realized what it was, the horns of Tashban blowing for the closing of the gates. "Don't be a silly little coward," he said to himself. "Why, it's
only the same noise you heard this morning. But there was a great difference between a noise heard letting you in with your friends in the morning and a noise heard alone at nightfall shutting you out. Now that the gates were shut, he knew there was no chance of the others joining him that evening. Either they're shut up in Tashban for the night, he thought to himself, or else they've gone on without me. It's just the sort of thing that Iris would do. But Bree wouldn't. Oh, he wouldn't. Now would he? In this idea about Iris, Shasta was once more quite wrong. She was proud and could be hard enough, but she was as true as steel and would never have deserted a companion, whether she liked him or not. Now that Shasta knew he would have to spend the night alone, it was getting darker by the minute, he began to like the look of the place less and less. There was something very uncomfortable about these great, silent shapes of stone. He had been trying his hardest for a long time not to think of Gauls, but he couldn't help it any longer. Oh, ow, help! He shouted suddenly, for at that very moment he felt something touch his leg. I don't think anyone could be blamed for shouting if something comes up from behind and touches him, not in such a place and at such a time when he is already frightened. Shasta, at any rate, was too frightened to run. Anything would be better than being chased around and round the burial place of the ancient kings with something he dared not look at behind. Instead, he did what was really the most sensible thing he could do. He looked around, and his heart almost burst with relief. What had touched him was only a cat. The light was too bad now for Shasta to see much of the cat, except that it was very big and very solemn. It looked as though it might have lived for long, long years among the tombs all by itself. Its eyes made you think it knew secrets it could not tell or would not tell. "Puss, puss," said Shasta, "I suppose you're not a talking cat." The cat stared at him harder than ever. Then it started walking away. And of course, Shasta followed it. It led him right through the tombs and out on the desert side of them. There it sat down, bolt upright with its tail curled round its feet and its face set towards the desert and towards Narnia in the north, as still as if it were watching for some sort of enemy. Shasta lay down beside it with his back against the cat and his face towards the tombs. Because if one is nervous, there's nothing like having your face toward the danger and having something warm and solid at your back. The sand wouldn't have been seemed very comfortable to you, but Shasta had been sleeping on the ground for weeks, and he hardly noticed it. Very soon, he fell asleep, though even in his dreams, he went on wondering what had happened to Bree and Arvis, and when he was wakened suddenly by a noise he had never heard before. Perhaps it was only a nightmare, Shasta said to himself. At that same moment, he noticed that the cat had gone from his back, and he wished that it hadn't left. But he lay quite still without even opening his eyes, because he felt sure he would be more frightened if he sat up and looked around the tombs and in the loneliness, just as you and or I might lie still with bedclothes over our heads. But then the noise came again, a harsh, piercing cry from behind him out in the desert. Then, of course, he had to open his eyes and sit up. The moon was shining brightly. The tombs, far bigger and nearer than he had thought they would be, looked gray in the moonlight. In fact, they looked horribly like huge people, draped in gray robes and that covered their heads and their faces. They were not all nice things to have near you when spending a night alone in a strange place. But the noise had come from the opposite side, from the desert. Shasta had to turn his back on the tombs, and which was something he really didn't like, and stare out across the level sand. The wild cry rang out again. I hope it's not more lions, Shasta thought to himself. It was, in fact, not very like the lion's roar he had heard on the night when he met Huin and Arvis. It was really more like the cry of a jackal. But of course, Shasta did not know this. Even if he had known, he would not have wanted very much to meet a jackal. The cries rang out again and again. There's more than one of them, whatever they are, Shasta thought. And I think they're coming nearer. I suppose if he had been an entirely sensible boy, he would have gone back through the tombs nearer to the river where there were houses, and wild beasts would be less likely to come. But then there were, or he thought there were, the gulls. To go back through the tombs would mean going back past those dark openings to the tombs, and what might come out of those things. It may have been silly, but Shasta felt he would rather risk the wild beasts. Then, as the cries came nearer and nearer, he began to change his mind. He was just going to run for it when suddenly, between him and the desert, a huge animal bounded into view. As the moon was behind it, it looked quite black, and Shasta didn't know what it was, except it had a very big, shaggy head and went on all four legs. It did not seem to have noticed Shasta, for it suddenly stopped, turned its head towards the desert, and let out a roar which re-echoed through the tombs and seemed to shake the sand under Shasta's feet. The cries of the other creatures suddenly stopped, and he thought he could hear feet scampering away. Then the great beast turned to examine Shasta. "It's a lion. I know it's a lion," thought Shasta. "I'm done. I wonder, will it hurt much? I just wish it was over. I wonder, does anything happen to people after they're dead? Oh, here it comes." And he shut his eyes and grit his teeth really tight. But instead of teeth and claws, he only felt something warm lying down on his feet. When he opened his eyes, he said, "Why, it's not nearly as big as I thought. It's only half of the size." "No, it's quarter of the size." "I do declare, it's only the cat. I must have dreamt all that about being as big as a horse." And whether he really had been dreaming or not, what was now lying at his feet and staring him out of the countenance with its big, green, unwinking eyes was the cat, though certainly one of the largest cats he had ever seen. "Oh, Puss," gasped Shasta, "I am glad to see you again. I have been having such horrible dreams." He at once then lay down, back down again, back to back with the cat as they had been in the beginning of the night. The warmth from this cat spread all over him. "I'll never do anything nasty to a cat again as long as I live," Shasta said, half to the cat and half to himself. "I did once, you know. I threw stones at a half-starved, mangy old stray." "Hey, stop that." For now, the cat had turned around and given him a scratch. "None of that," said Shasta. "It isn't as if you could understand what I'm saying." Then he dozed off. Next morning, when he woke, the cat was gone, the sun was already up, and the sand was hot. Shasta, very thirsty, sat up and rubbed his eyes. The desert was blindingly white, and though there was a murmur of noise from the city behind him, where he sat, everything was perfectly still. When he looked a little left and west, so that the sun was not in his eyes, he could see the mountains on the far side of the desert, so sharp and clear that they looked only a stone's throw away. He particularly noticed one blue height that divided into two peaks at the top and decided that that must be Mount Pyre. That's our direction, judging by what the raven had said, he thought. So I'll just make sure of it, so as not to waste any time when the others show up. So he made a good, deep, straight furrow with his foot, pointing exactly to Mount Pyre. The next job, clearly, was to get something to eat and drink. Shasta trod back through the tombs. They looked quite ordinary now, and he wondered how he could have ever been afraid of them, then down into the cultivated land by the riverside. There were a few people about, but not very many, for the city gates had been open several hours, and the early morning crowds had already gone in. So he had, of course, no difficulty
doing a little raiding, as Bree called it. It involved a climb over a garden wall, and the results were 3 oranges, a melon, a fig or two, and a pomegranate. After that, he went down to the riverbank, but not too near the bridge, and he had a drink. The water was so nice that he took off his hot, dirty clothes and had a dip. For, of course, Shasta, having lived on the shore all his life, had learned to swim almost as soon as he had learned to walk. When he came out, he lay on the grass looking across the water to Tashpan, all the splendor and strength and glory of it. But that made him remember the dangers of it, too. He suddenly realized that the others might have reached the tombs while he was bathing and gone on without me, as likely as not. So he dressed in the fright and tore back at such a speed that he was all hot and thirsty when he arrived, and so the good of his bathe was gone. Like most days when you are alone and waiting for something, this day seemed about 100 hours long. He had plenty to think about, of course, but just sitting alone, just thinking, it's pretty slow going. He thought a good deal about the Narnians, and especially about Corin. He wondered what had happened when they discovered the boy who had been lying on the sofa and hearing all their secret plans wasn't really Corin at all. It was very unpleasant to think of all those nice people imagining him a traitor. But as the sun slowly climbed up to the top of the sky and then slowly began going downward to the west, and no one came and nothing happened, he began to get more and more anxious. Of course, he now realized that when they arranged to wait for one another at the tombs, no one had said anything about how long they would wait. He couldn't wait here for the rest of his life. Soon it would be dark again, and he would have to endure another night, just like last night. 12 different plans went through his head, all wretched ones, and at last he fixed on the worst plan of all. He decided to wait till it was dark and then go back to the river and steal as many melons as he could carry and set out for Mount Pyre alone, trusting for his direction to the line he had drawn that morning in the sand. It was, of course, a crazy idea, and if he had read as many books as you have about journeys over deserts, he would have never have dreamed it. But Shasta, of course, had read no books at all. Before the sun set, something did happen. Shasta was sitting in the shade of one of the tombs, when he looked up and saw 2 horses coming towards him. Then his heart gave a great leap, for he recognized them as Bree and Huynh. But the next moment his heart sank down to his toes again. There was no sign of Arvarus. The horses were being led by a strange man, an armed man, pretty handsomely dressed, like an upper slave in a great family. Bree and Huynh were no longer got up like pack horses, but saddled and bridled. What could all this mean? Oh, it's a trap, he thought to himself. Somebody has caught Arvarus, and perhaps they've tortured her, and she's given them the whole thing away. They want me to jump out and run up and speak to Bree, and then I'll be caught too. And yet, if I don't, I may be losing my only chance to meet the others. Oh, I wish I knew what had happened. And he skulked behind a tomb, looking out every few minutes and wondering which was the least dangerous thing to do.